Hello, listeners, and welcome once again to Season 2 of Food Conversations. It's a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Today we have, once again, a guest who's been on the show before and has a lot to say about the food situation in the Shoe Swap, and that is Brad DeMille, who is co-owner with his wife, Kelly, of DeMille's farm market, where he's on land owned by his family for over a half century and has successfully maneuvered into the hearts of the local residents, a business that is deeply embedded in this community, started by his father years ago, brought back from the economic recession in the 1980s, and now under Brad's direction, a thriving and well-respected local business. Brad, welcome to Food Conversations.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation.
Delighted to have you here again and to get your take on what's happening now to our world and the world of food. As listeners are only too aware, there have been some major changes in food distribution in the last week or two as a result of some dramatic events precipitated literally on our heads by climate change. The so-called atmospheric rivers have poured water onto especially the lower half of British Columbia, the southern half, and have disrupted supply chains for just about everything, but in particular for food, and have resulted in some fairly dramatic events in terms of food flying off the shelves of local retailers. And Brad, with your business, it's been no exception. And that has led you and lots of other people to start thinking about what we have called a theme of our program, which is food sovereignty. That is bringing food and making it available to us locally of high quality and under our local control. So, Brad, you'd already had some changes take place in your sales patterns as a result of COVID, even before this sort of atmospheric dump had taken place on our heads. What was that like? What did COVID do to your business?
Well, initially we were nervous, as everyone was, because we were on a path that we had never walked down before. And the difference, I think, between now and what we've learned over the last couple of years almost now, is that the first rush on it in 19, when it first started, was people were generally panicked. And I think, like most conditions, we become a little more conditioned and used to some of these reactions and emergencies. The last reaction wasn't quite as dire as the very first one. But on the same hand, we had complete restocking every day because the supply line wasn't challenged. With this challenge, the items on the shelves disappeared very, very quickly because most grocery stores proper don't have more than a two-day window of supply that's not coming into them, whether it's from the east or some from the west or from the south. And this is what this current challenge has shown, is that if one of those roads, or three of them in this case, gets shut off, you have a very small window to grab that food. And the difference between the two was that we had continual supply in early 19 of product all the time. And we anticipated a rise in prices, which we saw. And we're seeing this fall, not only COVID-related shortages due to labor, transportation, and things like that, but general product depletion. Because if we're tending to hoard or buy more people, buy more product, the Americans, are where we're getting it from, are also seeing the same trend. So they're preempting our supply by being a kind of stockpiling their goods for themselves before we even have an opportunity.
So
that,
you noticed
our shortage.
So you noticed a change in the purchasing habits of people when COVID came along. You noticed that they started to buy a little bit more locally, did you?
I think the appetite for local has been almost insatiable for going on 2 years. And it really was triggered by the COVID event, knowing that we should be buying most of our food or as much as we can, especially when it's in season, because we really only produce, can consume roughly 40 to 60% of what we actually eat is what we make ourselves. That's a pretty staggeringly low number.
Indeed, indeed. And there are many producers who have shipped out of this area to faraway places as well, which is compounding the problem. And we'll talk about that a little later in the program. But when on a Monday the atmospheric river dumped its load on the lower mainland, people were stranded, lives were lost, but highways were essentially made impassable. You had on the day after that event, you had quite an event in your own store. Why don't you describe the scenario when the crowds descended on DeMille's Food Market and things started to happen? What happened?
Well, it was interesting that morning because there was probably half a dozen cars waiting for us as we opened the doors at 8 o'clock, and sometimes in the fall, it's kind of a sluggish, let's get going here. It's not near the energy you typically get in the summertime, but
sure.
this event definitely had people waiting at the gates to come in. And what we found was that day, particularly the first day and even the second day, and it continued on, but the first day was roughly between 7 and 10 times busier than a normal day in November.
That must have been a madhouse. It must have been a madhouse.
It was bizarre because we have about 30 shopping carts, and every one of them was out of the stall at one point.
They were wandering around the store.
and they were looking for things that not only your food is your entertainment, it's also a source of comfort, too. And I think that people were looking for a bit of both. you know, if we run out of food, what are we going to get stuck with? Oh, this looks good.
And let's buy everything.
They were overbuying maybe different categories they wouldn't have normally tested their taste buds in. But if they're going to go home and stay cooking with their beets and potatoes, they're probably wanting some extra sauce on it and things like that to make it. So their chefing isn't the ultimate grade of their
They
food.
Were spicing up their lives with your products.
Exactly.
So, if I remember correctly, you indicated that about 60% of your shelves were empty in that first day. It was a vacuum cleaning exercise.
Yeah, we actually were looking at it as an advantage because some of the things you just don't quite get to sometimes, dusting that one shelf that maybe has the floor movers on it and things like that. And we found that after 2 or 3 days of that same exercise, we were finding lots of gaps and holes in our supply.
You found some dust bunnies. You found some dust bunnies you didn't even know you had.
Well, you know, it's a farm, and sometimes the farm sneaks in. We tried to curtail that as much as possible, but with short labor numbers lately, it's always tough to get that last dusted shelf done.
So what did you do? You did a sort of a militaristic operation to restock the shelves. Describe how that was.
Well, what we started doing, because the way we store stuff is different than a traditional grocery store, we have a very large back-end cooler that we can store up to 300,000 pounds of apples locally. When I bring oranges up, we can bring 48 pallets at a time and put them in our cooler. So we have an ability to warehouse not only other folks' products, but our own product. It gives us a depth of supply that's beyond the two-day chain that grocery stores typically have as a supply line. And that gives us a tremendous strength and a sort of a bastion of where to go for your potatoes, onions, and these kinds of things that we store for you. Because they're locally made, we were able to not only tax their supply again. I ran to Kelowna 3 times towards the end of the week just to grab more potatoes, tomatoes, lettuces, and things like that I could grab from my local marketers in Kelowna because their supply somewhat from down south. But of course, they were seeing challenges too because everybody was calling them.
Would it be fair to say that because your food is fresher, it stores longer? I know there's a supply chain when it's long and refrigeration isn't exactly 100%. Foods just don't survive as well. But you have so much local stuff. It lasts longer in your coolers. Would that be fair to say?
Well, if you can take the travel time out of something that comes from California or Mexico or Florida or Texas, you take that, 2 weeks, a week.
Yeah.
There's not that many flights anymore, so they're not coming in by plane as much as they were. There's no mistake why WestJet charges you $50 a bag. They'd rather put a bag of potatoes on there and haul freight if they're not going to haul your dirty laundry back from wherever it comes from. We see a resilience in the supply because we, again, have a good relationship. It's not a one-off as an emergency. It's a defined relationship that we've had for many years. And so we tend to be one of their first suppliers that are supplied to us every single day, not just when we absolutely sure. need them in as an emergency.
So they go out of their way to help you because you know them and they know you, right?
Yes, and it's unfortunate that we can't quite figure out how to grow everything we need in the winter months, but those solutions are beginning to take shape a little bit, I think.
Indeed. Now, on the day, the first day when the shelves had emptied, you told me that in 45 minutes, you got 3.5 tons of food on the shelves, and everybody was working at it like mad.
When we finally got our first load on the three, when they had opened it for commercial traffic, we got 9 skids, I can't remember now. I'll tell me, it was 6,000 pounds of product that we, between the six of us working, we put it out in seriously 45 minutes. And it was like a game show. We were like rushing out while people were putting it in the hole. People were taking it out of the hole where it was. It was quite exciting because people weren't checking and looking over the quality, even though it was fantastic. Surprisingly, we thought we were going to be stuck with a bunch of junk that was stuck in their warehouse for a yeah. week while they were waiting for our truck. Honestly, the quality was quite remarkable. So California did a remarkable job supplying us for what we needed. And honestly, it was pretty fun though, because the whole staff was engaged in this little game show event that we were at. So,
you know, someday you're going to have to put in a video in your store so that if something like this happens, you can put it out on America's Funniest Videos or something like that. It sounds like it was a wild time. This has also caused some reflection. And one of the things you've been reflecting about is the timing of deliveries and being patient and waiting for things to happen rather than expecting them just instantly. And customers are starting to be that way as well. Is that not fair to say?
Absolutely.
You're getting a sense of let's just wait for the good stuff rather than rushing madly off and getting it instantly, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, we found that a lot of the items that we were being challenged on, like your spinaches and spring mixes and these kind of fresh things we've been used to eating because of transport availability, those were the first things already to be supply challenged as it was. We supply a number of restaurants in town, and a lot of you use the spinach salads and spring mixes for your fancy salads that you get, whether it be pizza or Italian or Greek or Mexican, whatever it is. You tend to take these little fancier salads and make your dish. And that was the very first thing that was gone.
And were people surprised to see how much food you actually had on the shelves? I mean, your supply chain is pretty strong.
We've seen a lot of new faces because as a default, we're out of town a mile or so. And sometimes not your first thought of going to a grocery type store, because we're not a grocery store that sells boxes traditionally. We sell the fresh stuff, the stuff that's hard to do.
Right.
And I think that people saw that and they maybe awakened to the fact that, hey, because it's easy to fall in that boutique market. Oh, they're expensive. And certainly we have expensive stuff. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But you can also buy almost anything you want on the bargain rack for 75 cents.
So customers are learning new things about your store. New customers are coming in the door as they realize the benefits of local food. But in at all levels of the food system, there is some more thought taking place these days. One of the thoughts is, where are the supply lines going to run if food is coming from anywhere but locally? The food now seems to be moving more sort of west to east and in different ways. Could you describe some of those different food patterns, distribution patterns?
Well, what we were able to do is we were able to sort of recap where our product was coming from. Instead of coming through the coast shipping, and it seems like a long ways to come for being stored there and then coming to us through not really a central distribution, but more of a coastal distribution. And we found that there was a good supply coming out of Alberta that was coming up through the states, that supply line wasn't compromised at all. The Jimmy Patterson Food Group has a good supply line through the Calgary that goes up to the state. They don't really back ship. I think they go back to the coast, and sometimes it goes back to Alberta again, which is kind of like our egg grading. It goes to the coast and then comes back. And this is where a lot of people, like milk and eggs, were being dumped and stockpiled because they couldn't get them to their grading station down at the coast. But Alberta offered a tremendous way to get them here, besides the challenge to the mountain. And, you know, with the improvements on the one, that certainly adds time. And time is money. Like everyone knows, that the longer the truck drives, the more it costs to get it here. There are certainly allowances for those price increases. We didn't really see a big rise in prices. Honestly, it was very nice to see because people weren't gouging. And we even softened our margins a little bit to make sure that people could afford to buy these foods they needed.
Sure. So you saw the whole system being kind of shaken up, people looking for food in different ways and different kinds of food, and the suppliers and the distributors also doing things differently as well. One of the things you said to me that I think is, and you've mentioned this before when we had you on the show before, and that was about how many local producers you have supplying your store with local produce. And obviously everybody was in this particular soggy boat together. Did you notice that those kinds of relationships with all these local producers were changed by the strenuous implications of the climate events that were taking place?
Well, absolutely. I think that some of the growers that were, like, let's say we're a small buyer from, we're seeing backlogs not being able to ship out of the area. A lot of our product that's grown in the interior, I mean, we used to grow a ton of potatoes, like tons of potatoes and onions and cabbage and beets. And what we're seeing is that those growers just aren't growing the volume because we can actually buy them from the state as a habit cheaper than we have ever in the past, which makes farming even less profitable. And we've lost those farmers that wanted to grow those types of things. We've become, honestly, we sell more carrots in a year than we do potatoes now. I would have never guessed that 10 years ago that a carrot was going to be worth $3.99 a pound to eat on your table carrot, and it's nice and sweet. But I tell you what, it's tremendously better than anything you're going to get from tired ground in California.
Yeah, you said that people are going back to their roots, and it's in more than one sense. They're going back to the food kind of patterns that were common before, but also to things like root vegetables. Food that lasts longer, that can stay in their larder or their pantry longer, or their fridge.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of folks. I don't know how many beets we sold in the last 2 years, but I swear everyone knows how to make borscht now, I think. And you know what? That kind of a meal is not just a one-off where you eat it and there's some leftovers. This is a pot that you can eat for largely 5 days. Freeze what you have left over. If you've got power out, the frozen block will eventually thaw. You can eat it. So there's lots of resiliency in these type of root vegetables that you can make into all kinds of things. It doesn't sound that exciting on the surface, but once people get a little more creative with their cooking, they can actually dance it up a little bit. And honestly, I absolutely enjoy a great root vegetable, whether it be yams and sweet potatoes. They're so delicious, and you give it a little bit of time.
I want to let listeners know that Brad said something that if he'd said it on the other side of the Rockies, like Katie Lang said when she said she was interested in eating vegetarian food, you said veggies are fun. And I wonder if that's becoming a more broadly appreciated point of view.
Well, I think as our diets and stuff become more front and center, and we know what the evolution of eating too much meat, whether it be beef, pork, chicken, turkey, all these things, you look at which your how you get your calories. And I think vegetables are a good substitute. And a lot of what we're doing now is replacing that big 10-ounce piece of meat on the plate with a 3-ounce more reasonable side, and then maybe adding some better salads that we've gotten used to because the timeline has been so easy to get it here. As soon as the salad timeline is being challenged, then you go back to what else is left on your plate. And a lot of it had to do with the starches and the extra things you can get from squash and those kinds of things that replaced maybe that the bigger salad.
One of the outcomes of that is that people who used to drink a lot of milk as such are now turning to other dairy products like cheese and also to plant-sourced alternatives to milk. There seems to be more interest in that, right?
Oh, we've seen a tremendous shift. I don't know if almond milk is the answer, and I probably have an opinion on that, and it's not, because it has a lot of effect on the environment through insecticides and insects and things like that.
Huge water consumption as well.
There's been a lot of studies on some of the, because it is a seed. It has different natures or different properties that come out after they're squished that maybe are not fantastic for humans to eat on a regular basis. But we've seen a big shift in the dairy industry. Not that it's going away, but it's certainly less volume on the adult side of things. They're more using it for coffee additions, and baking has been good because the whipped cream and stuff. It was interesting during the milk run when everyone was buying milk like they had never drank milk before. There was no virtually no table cream and no heavy whip because the milk producers can make probably 4 jugs of 4 liter with the milk fat that's in a liter of 18% table cream. So they could almost make the same those 4 products instead of 1 product. So when you notice there was no whipped cream, it was because they were utilizing that milk fat for larger volumes of product. And so they're smart. They were satisfying a need and not giving away the fat that maybe they didn't realize their best volume of sales.
It's interesting that milk, fluid milk consumption is decreasing. 35 years ago, I wrote a column for the local newspaper talking about the health impacts of milk consumption as sort of the basic dietary staple. At one point, the industry talked about milk as nature's most nearly perfect food. And I had a very negative reaction from both local farmers, but also from public health people, because in terms of human health, it was construed to be the best food, especially for children. Now there's been a very dramatic rethinking of that, as it turns out that drinking cow's milk, as opposed to human milk for babies, is not actually a very good thing. So there is evidence of changing attitudes influenced by health considerations as well as environmental considerations. Now, you've also started to see expanded food production locally, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about Mark in Armstrong and his lettuce operation. That seems to be the kind of example of the new pattern of food production in this area. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, Mark actually came by to see us. His product, he grows in Armstrong in a hydroponic with a little bit of soil plug and the lettuces. There's romaine, there's crinkly green leaf lettuce, and then another green lettuce. And he does also microgreens. He grows these all in Armstrong. It's an amazing facility that's all automated. Obviously, there's some manpower in getting the seeds in the trays, but the watering and the substrate that they grow in is all computer done. It's really a cool operation. It's like you've gone into the future when you go to this place. What was the cool part about it is that Mark had a challenge with his stuff going to the coast, to the fancier restaurants and things. So he had a backlog of products. So he had a little time to come see us. He wanted to come see us before. He just hadn't quite made it. You know, it's a long ways to Armstrong. I love this product. And, you know, in itself, it looks a little small on the outside. But we're selling these as cheaply as we can so we can get them into people's hands, because I really believe that this is a solution for 365 days of the year, not just in a pandemic flood river conditions.
It's a stable supply.
Absolutely. And I would love to have him in my store every day of the year. And people just need to not fall back asleep to where this stuff comes from. Because if you eat one of Mark's lettuces, we made 3. I think I sent you a picture of the 3 buds.
We
washed them up, a little warm water wash, and then you dry them, put them back in the fridge. And the thing was so crispy. It was delicious on its own with no dressing.
I hear you're going to be doing a compare and contrast exercise.
Starting this week, we're going to get some supply in here. So every time you buy a U.S. or a shipped-in lettuce, let's say it's leaf lettuce or romaine, or even romaine heart, we're going to give you one of Mark's little lettuces as an accompaniment, little side thing, for you to compare. And I believe the only way for you to know the product is for you to eat it. And if you set the two side by side, the blind taste test, guarantee Mark's lettuce is going to win every single time. And if we can make it so a local guy can get his, get him on the, get going, make it a part of your habit. And I believe, you know, I don't care if I make a cent on this, as long as we can eventually get a market for this and make it so he's healthy enough to continue. And this could be an example of what else we can do after this.
Now, he's also able to grow with fewer sort of pesticides and other kinds of chemicals because he has such carefully controlled growing conditions. Is that not correct?
Yes, it was absolutely. I had to put booties on. My head was covered. Well, probably because it should be. But anyway, and we walked in with almost like medical like sanitation, and it was super clean, like unbelievable. There was nothing out of place. And this place is huge. It must have been 20, 40 foot sea cans, all with like tens of thousands of lettuces rotating over the course of a 24 hour period. Watering, different levels of light when they're either germinating or doing whatever to get them to market. I think it takes 11 weeks to get a lettuce from zero to the market. And he rotates, I think, one sea can every week, I think is what he was saying. So it was pretty awesome to see. And I would love it to be his best customer. It would be so fun because I think it's our responsibility to steward this through and not to ignore that.
And this is a pretty clear-cut example of developing a form of food sovereignty. Local food produced, it's interesting you said that going to Armstrong was a long way to go, but going to California or Mexico or New Zealand would be even longer, I would say. And yet in the local scene, that's a goodly distance, but so much shorter than having stuff shipped up from California or over from Calgary even, or from Toronto. And that must make things much easier for you. You can get on the phone and just call Mark and say what you need, and that you can have this sort of intimate communication pattern.
It takes a little bit more sweat equity from yourself because like when we buy like strawberries from Armstrong, my guys, Kevin and the Reimer boys, will call me, and then an hour later, I could be there, pick them up, and be back. And they're literally just off the field. They start at 4 o'clock in the morning. I get a call at 9 o'clock. I have them back in the store by 11. They were just picked 6 hours before. That's pretty cool.
I can imagine listeners hearing how fast the food goes from farm to table, farm to store and then to table, that I'm sure there's a few mouths watering right now hearing you say that. It's all part of a changed pattern of food production and food consumption and food distribution, all those sort of portions of the food system together. It seems to me, I'm sure there's some listeners as well who are saying, well, hydroponics indoor reminds me of something. And what it reminds them of course, is growing cannabis. And cannabis technology, it would seem, is spreading a little bit further than the simple growing of pot.
Well, I think that just walking through Mark's facility would be an example of what a hydroponic clone operation would look like for the pot industry. I'm sure that none of that is lost on these guys. And I think as the pot business and all this has maybe seen a bit of a decline initially, we're all gung-ho about it. There's certainly some fallout on the side's facilities failing, and then someone picking up the ball sort of half paid for it and then could actually get a start at this. And it's really encouraging to see this start to happen.
Sounds good. Now, Mark's got sea cans, and just for listeners who haven't heard the term before, could you describe a sea can? It sounds like the big steel box, but on some different pathway.
Oh, I think these, it's probably a loose description because these things are specifically made brand new for this event. I don't think they're one wares from China as they came and they never went back. As you see, like big steel box sells a lot of the one-way trippers, and then we use them for storage. Great material. Problem is they're made out of metal, which condenses. There's no insulation value in these. These are made out of brand new steel, insulated and completely bacteria-free from whatever was in there prior to that. And they're definitely, the doors are a little bit different, but they're basically an 8x8 front opening, 40 feet long. And they're, for someone buying a home stored, you see them everywhere. You can't buy anything better or make anything better because it's completely impervious to mice, main thing. But the only problem is they do have lots of condensation inside, typically outside. But his are inside of a big concrete building that they put up in 5 days. And then put all this technology around it with the monitors and the watering and the lighting, and it's like being on a spaceship when you go in there. It's pretty awesome, Warren. I encourage you to go talk to Mark and get a tour. I think it'll be so enlightening to get your take on your feeling in there, because I think it feels like you're in a solution right there. It's pretty cool.
What sort of capital expenditure would there be involved? This is, you said there's 40 of them. It must have been a bit of a venture to get started up. I'll be happy to get Mark on the show and to tell me, but just from your own perspective, you know a little bit about what it's like to have to start businesses going and make them thrive.
Yeah, well, there's 20 40-foot sea cans that I could see inside of a prefab concrete slab building. Mm-hmm. I know what a building like that costs. Just it's got to be millions. It's got to be. And he's selling it at 95 cents a lettuce at a time. his ROI is a lot of investment. And this is why I think you need community partners like ourselves, Askew, right. And places like that that can get the volume out for this young fellow that has a young family that he needs our commitment to this. And without that, you're going to these big corporates that they don't care about your bottom line. All they do is care about their bottom line, typically. Right. And they'll give you pennies where you should be making dimes. And to exist, he needs dimes.
For sure. And obviously, in that sense, this massive shift in purchasing habits that has taken place temporarily, but will probably persist at a lower level for the much longer term, has been a huge boon for him, as it has been for you. That would be fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. And I hope he sees us as an opportunity. We're a little bit weird to work with sometimes because we have stranger ideas than most traditional grocery stores, because we're not a grocery store. We're a fresh fruit market, a fresh produce and fruit market. And we have to think quickly because this stuff's not getting better. Where a box of something that can have 9 months of shelf date, we get some time to market that. These days you get something in, you kind of got to know what you're doing, and it's easy to lose very, very quickly. Our first week of handling marked lettuce, we weren't happy with the freshness level, so we actually ended up just making into little spring mixes and stuff so we could actually get it out there as a sample. Our aggression on sampling, because COVID really stopped a lot of that. It was very difficult to give anything away that you'd have to pull your mask off inside the store. So we've gone to actually committing to that sample that you can go home now and sample it. You don't have to compromise anyone else inside the store by pulling off your mask and chomping down on some fresh lettuce kind of thing.
Sure.
And the sampling program was very successful, just like Costco. But we're doing it a little different. We don't just sample the salty and sweet stuff. We sample the stuff that you're going to actually want to eat continually.
Yeah, well, I think that's a theme that's run through many of the shows on Food Conversations, and that is the notion of having a relationship between your retailer and the customer that enables the customer to really have a more meaningful experience around their food. They actually get to check it out and follow up on it in a much more comprehensive way. Now, Mark has used sea cans inside a concrete building, but there's also opportunities for other kinds of food growing processes. There are, for example, computer-controlled milking systems that work extremely well for dairy herds. And, of course, there's an increased use, and especially as the weather here is a little cooler than it is down the coast, there's increased use of things like greenhouses, insulated greenhouses. And you mentioned some things about greenhouses or growing sites under the surface of the ground. In other words, sort of geothermal kinds of greenhouses.
Yes. Well, what we're seeing now is the evolution and the maturing of that business. Instead of putting a plastic greenhouse that really has very little insulated value against our winters, because it ranges. Like if summer can go 45 degrees, I think winter could do the opposite. If anything's going to be true this year, this little illusion that we're in with 17 degrees is probably going away sometime soon.
It's gone away already. So this, it was two below this morning.
Yeah. So if we swing, like we could potentially swing 90 degrees in temperature from summer to winter. That's nuts. I don't care what you do to your greenhouse. If you're on top of the surface, you're not going to keep it warm. Everything in there is going to die of stress, and it's going to look like, you know, bleh. So the idea is that you put it underground, and I'm going to talk in Fahrenheit here, where your Earth temperature is 58 degrees.
Sure.
Just like geothermal, you're starting at a reasonable point. You hold your house at 70, 72. You only have to bring it up 12 to 14 degrees by artificial mechanical means or gas or whatever, fossil fuels. And same way in a greenhouse, if you can prevent that heat loss going out of the sides by the wind, and having the natural light, very, very important, because we realize that that's such a vital thing. Even though technology with LEDs and full spectrum lights has come full circle, we're still seeing that natural sunlight is really beneficial.
Sure.
For these plants. Unfortunately, here we have about 7 hours of daylight, it seems like, now, and then it's robbed at 3:30 in the afternoon again. I'd like to have that hour back in the afternoon. Thank you very much.
We'll put your message into the government of BC to get it switched around. Yeah, there are. What it really means is that there's many ways to have food production increase independent of the climate impacts, which, as you say quite rightly, are becoming more intense. The summers are hotter. The winters are wetter, not necessarily cooler, but they're definitely wetter. And that those kinds of climate change shifts can be quite challenging for people growing food. Let's drift off into another area, because you yourself have also in your in DeMille's Farm Market, although it is primarily a fresh produce store, you're also drifting off into some really fascinating new ventures. And I remember back in March when you were on the show, you had just purchased your 7-inch tortilla maker, tortilla press. And at the time, you said you're a little anxious because you didn't know how it would work. And I think Kelly had said something like, this better work. It costs a fair amount of money to buy a tortilla press. And what happened when you got that 7-incher out on the shelf and started to make tortillas?
Wow, that was a very fun day. For many years, I wanted to build tortillas or to press tortillas ourselves, but we could never have the future. Didn't look that clear. Excuse me. When we went into it, we got an ROI, return on investment. What we got from my accountant, took a look at the numbers through Kelly's behalf, saying, prove these numbers work for me. Give me a business model instead of the one in Brad's head, which is not always the one that actually wins. And I've had lots of failures, more wins than failures, which defines the success, I hope. But we started pressing these, and honestly, we have been so excited. We're close to our 100,000 tortilla by this year in 10 months. We're pretty excited about the future. In fact, we just received yesterday my brand new 12-inch press. So we're going to be able to do full-size wraps. We're working on 4 flavors with only 5 simple ingredients, no preservatives. And every one of those ingredients, including the water, is locally sourced, all in BC at this point. Once we get out of the patch on spinach and things like that, we may have to look at supplies there. But our intention was to only have local and Canadian products in our tortillas with as low of numbers of preservatives as absolutely possible.
So let's just pause for a moment and focus on what you've just said. What you've just said is locally produced food using local ingredients has been taking off like a rocket and is now expanding from 7 inches to 12 inches. But more importantly, it's something that can be marketed very successfully to a local customer base. You don't have to rely on people buying your food 1,000 kilometers away or 5,000 kilometers away, and you don't have to, as a result, import food from that same distance. What's that experience been like for you to see the incredible success of this one-off kind of operation and now expanding?
Well, it's interesting, the bread, because all of our bread and a lot of our flour products are all sourced out of Armstrong, which is through the Okanagan bread products, in addition to Snowcap Foods, which is a direct distributor of their product. We, in the whole time this this run on the shelves ran, we had no compromise in our supply from those folks because they're sourced here just down the road. And actually, it's very close to Mark's place anyway. It's from the lettuce. It's kind of funny. So I could actually go down and get the tortilla, the dough, and all the stuff I needed to keep my shelves. We had bread on the shelves the whole week, including tortillas. If you were to look at any other store that was supplied by the Coast Supply, they had no tortillas on their shelves because they either came from America or they're made somewhere on the coast with some type of a commercial press that clearly didn't make it here. But we had tortillas where nobody else had none. And I think if we can add that, plus mine are so much better. If you did a blind taste comparison, you probably would wrap my tortillas in the box that they taste like compared to how good these things are.
So. Knowing you, I think that you're not exaggerating. That actually is the case. And I think 100,000 tortillas are an eloquent reminder of the fact that what you're saying is true. The 12-inch tortilla already you're supplying other retailers in the community with your 7-inch tortillas, right? And you're going to be supplying more.
We have two food trucks now with the 7-inch, and of course that has seasonal limitations also because food trucks are kind of cold in the winter. We anticipate these 12-inch ones going, and we have discussions with a few restaurants in town, Cantina Varda, we have Barley Station, and we're hoping to get, as soon as our 12-inch come online, I would imagine we're talking in January now, by the time we get all this logistics worked out. We're hoping to expand into Vernon and Kamloops as a commercial supplier to these folks. We have distributors that we believe that we can do 1 million 12-inch in this 1 year coming up. Pretty lofty goal, but I think it's there.
Now, Brad, in the process of developing your tortilla operation, you had some conversations with the new Zest Food Hub, and obviously they have an important role to play in the community. For you, you were just a little bit big for what they're offering to local producers. You can just talk about that kind of balance that you worked out.
We were in discussions with the Zest Food Hub right from the start to mostly give some advice on how to get these products to market. If you're going to have someone come into a kitchen, why are they making them if you don't have an end plan where they're going to be marketed? We're very flexible in our ability to offer one-off products as long as they're done in a proper facility. So this lines right up to what we want to do, is getting folks into a certified kitchen with all the controls that need to be in place. We looked at possibly putting in this 12-inch press with a corn tortilla line, but it was just a bit big, taking up a bit too much space, and I think limiting their business plan overall to satisfy 10 to 20 different producers in there instead of having to, you know, pigeonhole it to 10 or even 6 because of the space that I may or may not take up. And to be fair, I can probably do it a better job at my place than to go out to a second location, because it just adds logistical nightmares to it. Not only adding cooling, transportation, you have to have it refrigerated from point A to point B. There's a lot of limits, and there's a lot of limitations on moving product around. Technically got to be governed by cold control measures through HACCP and different things like that. So.
Right. Yeah, it was just convenient. We will next season be talking to Tracy, who is the manager of the Food Hub, and we'll talk to her about what the Food Hub is really suited to do. But I think it's a sign of the success of your business that you've been able to build a volume and a size that would have been, as you say, a little bit big for that process. Now, there's another new development that I think is worth talking about in your operation, in your store, and that is that you have acquired, after much time has elapsed, a license to sell beer, wine, and liquor.
Yes, actually, we're closing in on, it's been over 2 years in process. We are now allowed by ALC, which is the Agriculture Land Commission, through the Kelowna branch, have been the first and only so far farm market in BC to sell BC beer, wine, spirits, and cider.
So was that 2-year process because you were the first? Was this something that the government just hadn't got the template worked out for? Is that why it took so long?
I think the appetite was there. It's just the process takes what it takes. I mean, you apply. COVID has slowed everything down so
sure.
much. I mean, we thought the mail was slow. Well, we're putting stuff on donkeys now and moving it to places. It's not, there's no hurry up and go. Even from an employee point of view, sometimes people put it on their desk. They're really not pushed that hard to get it up. And I think I've been very happy because every step we've made in the last 2 years has been a forward step. And we've never had backward steps, even though we're riding the donkey. We're going to get there eventually. And I think we knew that there was a goal, and we had to prove why we deserve this opportunity. And I'm really excited because of the 150 suppliers that produce not only jarred and canned and fresh goods and organic and lettuces, things like that. We think that we can easily satisfy another 150 winemakers here locally, all around the area through Kelowna. Maybe they don't have a big enough vent to get on the shelf at BC Liquor. And so I'll take those 10 cases and I'll sell them through until the next guy replaces that. And it could be one of the best wines you'll never taste on their shelves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the strength that we're offering. Not just the fact that we're selling booze because it sounds like fun. It's honestly, it doesn't sound like that fun in service because it's very expensive to stock a liquor store. And all the parameters on your signage, the size that it can be in the store, the governance when they come check on you, inventory controls, and all the stuff that you have to report to them. So it's been a big process. We're not done yet. We have a couple months left to, we're starting to build the liquor store now as far as the inside the store. We made some changes in our floor plan. So those are challenges that we're responding to. And I think that from a BC producer, not only like Sunny Bray, you can come to go to their vineyard, maybe taste it, but let's say they're closed on Sunday and you're heading back to Alberta on Sunday. You should be able to buy that at my store anytime you come by between 9 and closing time.
You've mentioned before when you were on the show before about how a lot of people who produce food, or in this case, alcoholic beverages, they're good at producing the beverage, but in terms of retailing it and putting it into the market, that's where your expertise has helped them out. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Well, it's like we work with artists. Artists, a lot of times, aren't their best business partner. And sometimes if you sit down with them before they grow it, give them a plan that's based on our consumption, not on their dreams, but on reality of where your business needs to go. Spread the grow out and anticipate the higher peaks in weather, anticipate watering cycles and different things like that, and extend your season and go places where compete where there's nobody else standing. A lot of times in BC, we've done this all the time, is you get 100 growers that grow the exact same thing, and end of July and most of August, all that product's available. These folks, they just don't have any value in that product because there's so much content out there that it brings their value of their product down. They can't make any money out because they're dumping it. Hmm. And what a lot of these growers have because of our, and it's not all us, we work with them very closely, what their ideals are. And they used to go to, whether it's farmers markets, and a lot of these guys of the 150 are only supplying to us, Askew's here at Armstrong, and Salmonar, because they see a market as opposed to setting up a tent for 1 or 2 days a week and trying to make that product. We can sell their product from the moment we open to the moment we close, properly managed, and then order as we need to. And they're finding that their volumes are going up at least double most of the time.
The other thing is that the volumes that you would sell and that you need to be able to put their products on your shelves, the volumes are much lower. As I think most people know, the provincial liquor control board will only take on a product line when they can stock it in all the shelves in all the stores in the province. Whereas you can actually have local, special, unusual kind of sources for your alcoholic beverages. You can have them quite, you know, small lots and special seasonal varietals and that kind of thing.
Yes, and as long as they're authorized by BC, the Liquor Board, to sell, there's obviously governance over that. Like, there's so many layers, you just can't even believe it. And we're going to go through their distribution point, which is where we contact these growers. So there's a lot of process to get it. Once we learn the process, I think it'll be a path that we're used to going on. Right now, we don't even know really what we're doing yet. But we will learn. I mean, we've learned a lot of things over the past 52 years to get to this point now, reacting to different market demands, and then also looking at what we are selling and don't need to sell because it's a non-mover and maybe that trend has gone away.
Yes. It speaking of trends going away and new trends coming on board, what we've been talking about through most of the program is the changing pattern of food distribution, food tastes, attitudes of people in the community towards the food that they eat and the foods that they buy. Would you say that there's, and of course the role of the climate crisis has been to accelerate a lot of those processes, as well as the COVID-19 doing the same thing. Do you see these trends moving us towards greater food sovereignty, you know, having control over the food supply locally, not having these long distribution patterns, et cetera, et cetera? Do you see that this is really starting to move things in the direction that I think many people think they should move?
Well, I think the thirst for local product and content has been almost insatiable this last 2 years, which has been fabulous. People are waking up to the fact that maybe you need to look at a different source. We used to grow these potatoes and onions, and now we don't have any growers to do that. I think we need to look back at that. Government involvement, that I don't know how effective they can be on it, encouraging it, whether it's grants for people to grow small pods of land unused. There's lots of fields out there that could support almost anything. Even growing plastic bags out of corn out of an old lot that really doesn't grow anything but pasture and weeds, where the cow used to graze. Let's say we don't eat cows on that pasture. We could grow enough corn on that 5 acres to make every bag in Salmon Arm. And it's not like you're taking away corn land that would be for food consumption. This is actually a good use of that kind of thing.
Sure.
So thinking outside the box and thinking, I'm growing my bags on that land for someone in Canada to make these bags, not someone in California or China to do it.
And not making them out of petroleum.
Yeah, instead of a large, because I know with the bag laws in town here, which we kind of forgot about during COVID because nobody wanted a used bag in your store because they were COVID. Who knew, right? We were pretty young at this in the day. And there's, of course, all the misinformation that you get. But if we could do that, I think those are things that we need to look at. And whether we need the stewardship of government, certainly it could be a conversation for that. I think the government's got lots of bills on its hands right now with fixing roads in the future. So tax-wise, it's going to be challenging to find any extra free money out there. So.
On the other hand, the benefits, both in terms of improved health of the population, in terms of reduced greenhouse gas production by long supply lines with trucks driving up and down highways, the benefits are going to be significant as well. The costs of continuing as we have are increasing all the time. The costs of repairing the highway is going to be in billions of dollars, and that's going to be taken out of the budget from the money that is earned from, say, fossil fuel royalties and that kind of thing. So there's a real broad trend towards the kind of business you're setting up and expanding in the shoe swap.
Yeah, exactly. When you look at these implications, that the cost of fixing all these roads and the carbon taxes and the taxes we pay at the pump for fuel, every time someone gets in a truck from Vancouver and the first load, that 9 skids of product on the 3, it took them 24 hours to get from Vancouver to Salmon Arm with those 9 skids for us. And technically, the driver's only allowed to drive, I believe it's 10 of 24 hours. So if you took that truck and he wanted that empty truck to get back to Vancouver, you got to put 3 drivers in that truck. So the truck never technically stops. So now you're paying 3 guys or 3 drivers overtime. They're driving 10 each, getting it back, dropping it to Mills and Askew's and Sam Murray, going back to Vancouver over the 3, another 24 hours to get back there to load up to come back again. The expense is going to be paid by the consumer.
Brad, I think you have just made the case that for the bean counters listening to this show, I think you've made the case for local food production and expanding it and increasing the volume and the quality, which is already obvious, of the food we eat in the shoe swap. Brad, we've come to the end of the show, and I'd like to thank you very much for laying out your efforts and your engagement in the process of improving food sovereignty in this part of the world. I think most listeners would agree that you're in the forefront of the move towards food sovereignty in this area. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. This has been awesome.
Terrific. Thank you.
This new series of food conversations, Shoe Swap Food Conversations for 2021, are produced by Shelley Corbin, Warren Bell, Steve Corey, and Tom Grady. These radio broadcasts are thanks to the work and collaboration of the Shoe Swap Food Action Society and the volunteers there who make things grow. Thank you for listening.